This is the tax update for May 19, 2008. This week, partnerships, liabilities, tax shelters, and different views of the same. The Tax Update podcast intended for tax professionals is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research and confirm items raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and document may be reproduced freely as long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the podcast. Such prohibited use include using the podcast or document as part of a CP presentation for which a fee is charged. The podcast is sponsored by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. Lineberg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information to tax practitioners that subscribe to their services. Visit them on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. 2 weeks ago, we talked about a failed attempt to structure a son-of-boss tax shelter, but the taxpayer failed to pay enough attention to dotting his I's and crossing his T's, and the tax court was able to dispose of that case without having to actually worry about whether or not the legal theory supporting a son-of-boss shelter really worked. However, that question has been dealt with by various courts this year with somewhat divergent views. The majority view is that it doesn't work, but even then, the why isn't necessarily consistent. This past week, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals rang in with its view of son-of-boss transaction in the case of Kornman Associates versus United States, 2008-1 USTC, paragraph 50,331. That affirmed the U.S. District Court decision in Calm Producer, Inc. versus United States, 2006-2 USTC, paragraph 50,554. The view the Fifth Circuit gave affirmed the IRS position that, in fact, the large capital loss claim did not exist because the obligation to close a short sale was a liability under Section 752. But the Fifth Circuit arrived at that view via a different route than the Seventh Circuit did in the earlier case of Semco Investors versus United States, 2008-1 USTC, paragraph 50,178. And the Fifth Circuit specifically rejected the view that the case of Helmer versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Case 1975-160, settled the matter that an option-style liability was not a liability for Section 752 purposes at the time the transaction was entered into and for all the years prior, a position that was adopted with little commentary by the District Court for the District of Colorado in the case of Sala versus United States, a recent taxpayer victory that got a lot of press and publicity. You may be thinking, wait, I don't do tax shelter work. I've never had a taxpayer who invests in a son-of-boss style transaction, and therefore none of this is applicable to me. However, these shelters make use of fundamental principles in partnership taxation. In fact, the court mentions that normally these are fairly simple. They may be complex in detail, but they're simple in the theory about why they work. And understanding both how the promoters claim the shelters worked under the law and the IRS arguments against that approach can be very instructive even if you only work with the simplest partnership arrangements. Because partnership taxation simply works differently than most other parts of taxation, and these quirks can come back to haunt us even if we're not dealing with a tax shelter. Now, the key to the working of son-of-boss shelter is the application of IRC Section 752. That provision, which we've discussed before, deals with the applicability of with the use of liabilities inside the partnership and their impact on computing basis of the partners in the partnership. The transactions that increase or decrease a partner's allocable share of liabilities are treated as if cash were contributed to the partnership if the partner ends up picking up an additional share of liabilities, or a cash distribution was made from the partnership if a partner's share of liabilities go down. Now, that distribution can occur for the simple fact that we paid off the loan. That can cause a deemed distribution of cash. Similarly, taking out a new loan is a deemed contribution of cash. Why is that important? Well, distributions of cash is one of the few ways you can trigger a gain from a partnership. The distribution of cash triggers a gain, unlike distributions of property, which normally don't trigger gains. However, that distribution of cash can be a deemed distribution, so our client may end up with a gain on a distribution from a partnership even when the client received no check. That's one of the gotchas we run into in partnership law. In this particular case, though, we're going to be looking at this from a slightly different perspective because in the design of a son-of-boss shelter, we're trying to make use of something as not a liability. That's going to be our whole design. Let's describe the transaction in question rather briefly. The taxpayer opened a brokerage account with a deposit of $2 million cash. That taxpayer then executed a short sale for $100 million worth of U.S. Treasury notes, receiving $102.5 million in exchange. Now, as we know, a short sale is when we borrow shares from shares, or in this case, notes, from the brokerage company, have those sold, we get the proceeds from the sale, but we have agreed that at some point in the future, we will make whole the brokerage firm by delivering equivalent shares to the brokerage firm. Now, the general rule for why you do a short sale, from an investment perspective, the straight economic theory is, I think the price is going down. So I will get $102 million today, and when I close out this sale, I'll be able to buy these for $90 million, thus pocketing that difference. That's the general rule economically, but these particular short sale wasn't interested in that. Rather, they were intentionally trying to find something that wouldn't move much, because they didn't want to take the risk of that going to a different amount by the time they had to close out the sale. Rather, they wanted something that would be closed out very shortly. In fact, this option, this short sale, only stayed open for a few days and would be at a predictable price, and at the end of the day, that we would then know exactly how much money we're going to be shorted. In this particular case, we had a designed-in loss of $200,000 on executing this transaction. Now, you may wonder, why are we entering a transaction where we fully expect, except in unusual circumstances, to have an economic loss of $200,000? Well, it's because if this works, we were going to get an actual tax loss of over $100 million. And the tax benefits from that tax loss of over $100 million could offset a large capital gain we were recognizing, which means that our tax reduction would more than pay, far more than pay, for the $200,000 loss we're going to get economically from this transaction, or that we fully expect to get from this transaction. I should add, it was theoretically possible the result might be different, but from a practical standpoint, there wasn't much chance it was going to be different. And in fact, when these are marketed, believe me, nobody ever talked about this coming out and working radically differently. The theory was, we're doing this because we know pretty much what's going to happen. Now, at the point we have got this short sale, we have $104.5 million cash in the brokerage account. Now, that cash could not be withdrawn until the treasury notes were returned to the brokerage firm. At this point, the brokerage account was contributed to a partnership in exchange for a 99.99% limited partnership interest in an entity. 3 days later, that interest was sold to another party for $1.8 million. That same day, the short sale was closed for $102.7 million. The court noted that the buyer never did end up with any authority of the brokerage account. Rather, Kornman retained that authority at all times and actually executed the closing on the transaction, since he was going to be the one kind of effectively on the hook. Now the magic starts, at least in the taxpayer's view. A sale of a partnership interest is generally treated as a sale of a capital asset. The sales price appears clear, $1.8 million. And at first glance, you might think the basis would be easy. The taxpayer put $2 million into this transaction. So we put $2 million in, we get $1.8 million out. That sounds like a $200,000 loss. But not so fast. In the taxpayer's view, if we respect the partnership as an entity, we're going to have to go through a 752 analysis and in that case get over a $100 million loss. Not unexpectedly, the taxpayer and the IRS had rather divergent views on how Section 752 would apply in this case. The taxpayer's view, as reflected on his tax return, went like this. The taxpayer had contributed assets with a basis of $104.5 million, the cash in the brokerage account. And the IRS agrees with that view in the end. However, the taxpayer is contended that because the obligation to close the short sale was one whose value could not be absolutely fixed at the time it was contributed to the partnership, at least in terms of dollars, it represented a contingent liability that could not be counted for purposes of Section 72. The taxpayer argued, as a taxpayer and sale successfully did in Colorado, that the principles used by the tax court in deciding the case of Helmer versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandums 1975-160, controlled here. Helmer dealt with taxpayers that sold options to sell a piece of real estate in the partnership. The party purchasing the option paid the partnership $150,000 in the first year and then paid $75,000 in each of the two following years to keep the option open to purchase the property. If the payer exercised the option, those amounts be deducted from the eventual purchase price. Now, under the standard tax law, receipt of cash for an option doesn't do anything initially from a tax perspective. Rather, we have to hold it in abeyance, waiting to see if the option is exercised, in which case this is part of the sale transaction of the underlying asset, or whether the option just expires, in which case then we just have the gain on that on the option transaction. Well, as noted, we sit there then, nothing has happened. Now, what the taxpayers in Helmer want to do is take the cash out of the partnership. However, prior to this transaction, they had very little basis in the partnership. Since the amount real received was for an option, there was not going to be any immediate income recognized, so we're going to be able to increase our basis by the income we'd recognize when $150,000 hit the bank account. Rather, that was deferred till it was exercised or expired. So the execution of the option did not cause our basis to increase. However, we want to take the cash out. We don't have basis unless we have a liability. Now, under Section 731A, if we receive a distribution of cash that's in excess of our basis, that triggers gain. In Helmer, the partner argued that the execution of that option arrangement gave rise to a liability in the amount of the option price received. However, the tax court did not agree that a liability arose. Now, the taxpayers in Kornman argue that their option liability should be treated similarly. Now, remember, in the Helmer case, we had a problem here that the taxpayers were going to get taxed on this distribution because they didn't get basis. Kornman doesn't want a liability, and we'll explain why here in a second. They claim also the treatment of options under Section 1233, which delays that recognition of gain, requires the treatment of the obligation to close the short sale also as not a liability under Section 72. They note that Regulation 1.1233-1A1 provides that for income tax purposes, a short sale is not deemed to be consummated until delivery of the property to close the short sale. A short sale is an open transaction on which we cannot compute the gain or loss till it is closed, thus rendering it like the transaction in Helmer, where the tax court refused to allow the partners to count their liability as basis until such time as we closed out the transaction. And at that point, we'd look at the actual transaction, and that gain or loss would determine what happened to our basis. Thus, when the property is sold for $1.8 million, we apply that against the basis in the partnership interest of $104.5 million. We end up with a capital loss of $102.7 million. Now, the taxpayer in this case actually is only claiming a loss of $102.6 million on the return for the eventually when it flows all the way out of everything. We have $100,000 kind of loss in some of the various entities we set up because it's a little more complicated than just a simple partnership being set up. But I suppose we're not that concerned about losing $100,000 in loss, considering that we had a $200,000 loss maximum in terms of economics, and we're getting over $100 million of losses. We can deal with the fact that $100,000 seems to kind of flow out of here, and we don't get to take that loss. Thus, for what was a net out-of-pocket cash for $200,000, we end up with a capital loss far in excess of that amount, if in fact the liability is counted does not count as liability, or you know that obligation doesn't count. Now, as we'll show later, if that obligation to deliver the shares is counted as a liability, the result is extremely different. Now, the IRS, as you might guess, views the transaction differently, and we'll look at their view now. The key difference is in the IRS's view, the obligation to deliver those treasury notes does give rise to a liability. That's important because that greatly affects the eventual sale calculation, though you have to go through a few hoops to get there. And perhaps counter to what you might expect, at first you were used to think in terms of corporate formation. In both calculations, we're going to get the same basis. The basis in the interest will not change. Under the government's views, here's what the contribution did to basis. We first get to add to our basis $104.5 million in cash we put in. We then subtract from our basis the obligation we're being relieved of $102.5 million. That is the obligation to restore the account. So now we're back to $2 million cash. However, we then add that the liability allocated to the partner. That is our $102.5 million liability. So now, hey, we're back to $104.5 million. Well, you know, what's the big deal now? The big deal is we now have a liability in the partnership allocated to the partner. Remember, under 752 B and D, if that liability comes out to us, that's a deemed distribution of cash, and that distribution of cash will be treated as part of the sales price for the partnership interest. That is our problem. Now, when we have that sale, therefore, in addition to receiving a note for $1.8 million, We are deemed to receive cash of $102.5 million, therefore having a sales price of $104.3 compared to the $104.5 basis, a loss of $200,000, the economic loss. Now, the IRS cites a number of revenue rulings in support of its position. It begins with Revenue Ruling 8877, which holds in part that, for purposes of Section 752 of the Code, the terms liabilities of a partnership and partnership liabilities include an obligation only if and to the extent that incurring the liability increases, creates, or increases the basis of the partnership of any of the partnership's assets, or gives rise to an immediate deduction to the partnership, or under Section 705A2B, currently decreases a partner's basis in the partner's partnership interest. In Revenue Ruling 9526, the IRS used that rationale to kind of flip it over and hold that a liability from a short sale is recognized, that a short sale creates an obligation on the part of the seller to return the borrowed securities. In addition, the cash received in the short sale is an asset of the partnership. Thus, the basis of the partnership's liabilities is increased. Therefore, PRSs, which is the entity that was used in the example here in the revenue ruling as the fact pattern we were describing, short sale creates a liability under Section 752 and the adjusted basis of the partnership interests of A and B are increased under Section 722 to reflect their shares of the liability under Section 752. That means if we execute a short sale in the partnership and we can get the cash out, unlikely, but let's say we can distribute the cash, we could take that cash to the partners. They could get that cash right now. And then down the line, when the debt's paid off, you know, that's when we'll recognize a reduction. But that would create basis instantly the need to restore that obligation. In another ruling issued in 1995 for corporate taxpayers, the IRS explicitly stated that the value of that liability would be the basis to which the short sale gave rise. Revenue Ruling 9545. And so 9545 tells us that the basis here for the liability is 102.5, the basis in the cash we received. Now, there are three different court holdings that have come down this year that we'll look at in this issue. Prior to the Fifth Circuit's holding we're looking at today, we've heard from the Seventh Circuit in a similar case, and more recently in April, from a U.S. District Court for the District of Colorado. In both of those cases, Treasury Regulation 1.752-6 plays a prominent role. That regulation was issued after the date the taxpayers in each of these cases invested in the transaction in question, but the regulation claimed a retroactive effective date back to October 18, 1999, which was before the transactions in question. Regulation 1.752-6A provides if, in a transaction described in Section 721, that's partnership formation, a partnership assumes a liability, defined in Section 358H3, of a partner other than a liability to which Sections 752A and B apply, then after application 752A and B, the partner's basis in the partnership is reduced, but not below the adjusted value of such interest, by the amount determined as of the date of the exchange of the liability. For purposes of this section, the adjusted value of a partner's interest in a partnership is the fair market value of that interest increased by the partner's share of partner liabilities under 1.752-1 and some 1.752-5. The Seventh Circuit in Semco Investors versus United States, 2008 TNT 27-8, on February 7th of this year, used that provision to hold that the IRS had properly disallowed a large capital loss from a partnership structure similar to the one we see here in Kornman & Associates. The provision would essentially kill the son-of-boss structure, so the key question was whether the retroactive application had been authorized by Congress and whether the IRS had made use of that authorization. In a 2006 case, a district court in Texas in Klamath Securities and Strategic Investors had held that Regulation 1.756-6 was not valid as applied retroactively, as the IRS had not specifically availed itself of the legislative grant Congress had applied to Section 309D6 of the Community Renewal Tax Relief Act of 2000, which provided regulations to be made retroactive to October 19, 1999, to prescribe rules for partnerships and S corporations that were similar to basis reduction rules for transactions that were contained in that law. The Seventh Circuit rejected the Klamath Court decision on this point, indicating that it was clear to it by the choice of the date that had no other relevant point of reference but that particular law, that the IRS had specifically invoked its authority to issue the regulation under that law, and retroactive application was allowed. The Seventh Circuit view was that the Klamath Court had held that if they had used that law, if they had invoked that law, the regulation would have been validly applied retroactively. Therefore, the Seventh Circuit said, we believe they did invoke it, therefore we're going to apply this law. However, a Colorado U.S. District judge was similarly not impressed with the Seventh Circuit's ruling in SEMCO, just as the Seventh Circuit wasn't impressed with Klamath. In the case of Sala versus United States, the court noted, SEMCO does not counsel a contrary conclusion. Initially, I note an opinion of the Seventh Circuit is not controlling on this court. Further, and now in a dig to the Seventh Circuit, an opinion curiously lacking substantive analysis. The SEMCO court did not analyze whether Treasury exceeded its statutory authority in promulgating this regulation. The SEMCO court based its conclusion regarding the regulation's retroactivity solely on the fact the retroactive date, October 18, 1999, was the same as the date authorized by Section 309. If the question presented in this case was whether the retroactive date in the regulation was a valid one, SEMCO's holding in this regard might have some persuasive relevance. As the validity of the regulation's retroactivity at all, however, it has none. The Sala court held that, in fact, the regulation exceeded the authority granted to the IRS under this law, and therefore it was irrelevant whether or not the date was a proper one, that the regulation went beyond what Congress had authorized. However, the Sala court would make the following comment in support of its position that, as we shall see, the Fifth Circuit would then take its own shot at. It held that the approximately $60 million capital loss claim was allegedly achieved by a series of predetermined steps orchestrated under the then-existing tax rule that disregarded short options as liabilities for purposes of establishing partnership basis. Under this rule, established in Helmer v. Commissioner of Internal Revenue, TC Memo 1975-160 from 1975, liabilities created by short options were considered too contingent to affect a partner's basis in the partnership. Now we'll look at the Fifth Circuit's view in this case. The Fifth Circuit goes about all of this in a different way, finding they don't even need to worry about that regulation that consumes so much ink in the other two cases, finding it's totally inapplicable. Regardless of that regulation's validity or whether it could be retroactive or whether it went beyond what Congress had authorized, the shelter falls apart because this court finds, unlike the Colorado District Court, Helmer does not require us to find that these options are not a liability. The Fifth Circuit begins by first deciding what level of deference it needs to give to the IRS's revenue rulings on the topic. And it decides it really doesn't need to give much deference to such rulings. The IRS believes that such rulings need to be given a high level of deference, and the Fifth Circuit outlines that position as follows. Both the IRS and the Fifth Circuit have stated that revenue rulings are entitled to less deference than Treasury regulations. Okay. Despite this fact, the government argues that revenue rulings should be entitled to Chevron deference, meaning that we would be required to follow them unless the IRS interpretation of the statute is arbitrary, capricious, or manifestly contrary to the statute. Quote, coming from the case of Chevron USA versus National Resources Defense Council, a United States Supreme Court from 1984 decision. Given the prominent role that revenue rulings play in a subsequent analysis, we feel compelled to address this argument. Noting, it says parenthetically, the Supreme Court has been conspicuously silent regarding the applicability of Chevron deference to revenue rulings. However, the Fifth Circuit is clear in its view on whether they're entitled to such deference, indicating that other circuits have not only gone along with the view that a Chevron level of deference should be given to revenue rulings. Rather, the Fifth Circuit holds, post-Meade, the various circuits that have addressed this issue have held that revenue rulings are entitled to Skidmore deference. In Meade, the Supreme Court affirmed the continued vitality of the Skidmore deference, which gives an agency interpretation some deference, whatever its form, given the specialized experience in broader investigations and information available to the agency, and given the value of uniformity in its administrative and judicial understandings of what the national law requires. Reasonable agency interpretations that do not involve notice and comment carry at least some added persuasive force and may seek a respect proportional to their power to persuade. We can discern, no appreciable difference between our previously enunciated standard and the Skidmore standard. They say C. Seeley Power, revenue rulings are merely persuasive. FOIL, revenue rulings are given weight as expressing the studied view of the IRS. We believe that our existing jurisprudence regarding the level of deference owed to revenue rulings is fully compatible with Skidmore, and we apply that standard today. Having gone this route, the Fifth Circuit now goes ahead, and maybe surprisingly after going to that length to tell us how much deference to give them, that the IRS revenue rulings are persuasive and will be followed in this case. It notes, one factor that gives a revenue ruling its power to persuade is its reasonableness. We are particularly struck by the absurd result that would arise if we accepted the appellant's argument that the obligation to close a short sale is not a liability for purposes of Section 752. We are reluctant to adopt any definition of a liability that would defeat the manifest intent of Congress and would allow the trust to continue its conspicuous raid on the Treasury through the use of this tax shelter. And just in case that last sentence didn't telegraph to you how the Fifth Circuit is going to go on this one, the Fifth Circuit goes on to give the following aside that probably won't be appreciated by the district judge in Colorado. Before we begin our excursion into subchapter K, we would be remiss if we did not comment on the elephant in the room. The trust acknowledges that it only suffered a $200,000 economic loss in connection with these transactions, yet it claimed a $102.6 million tax loss on its return. The trust used this fake loss in 1999 to offset over $2 million in legitimate income and capital gains in 2000 and 2001. The appellant's predetermined attempt to transform this wash transaction for economic purposes into a windfall for tax purposes is reminiscent of an alchemist's attempt to transmute lead into gold. Now, the Fifth Circuit deals specifically with the view that Section 1233 forces the IRS to treat the obligation to close a short sale as not a liability under Section 72. The Fifth Circuit summarizes the taxpayer's position as follows. At oral argument, the appellants asserted that Section 1233 defines whether an obligation is a contingent liability for purposes of Section 72. The appellants insist that Section 752 must follow Section 1233 as night follows day. However, the Fifth Circuit does not accept this point of view. They go on to explain, we believe that our conclusion that a partnership short sale of security creates a partnership liability within the meaning of Section 752 does not create tension or conflict with the deferred recognition of gain or loss prescribed for short sale transactions under Section 1233, quoting from the Selena partnership case. Simply put, there is no fundamental link between Section 1233, which deals with the calculation of capital gains and losses in short sales, and Section 752, which deals with the effect of liabilities on partnerships on a partner's outside basis. By its own term, Section 1233 does not purport to define the scope of the term liability under Section 752. The court goes on to complain about the one-sided treatment the taxpayer's position takes, noting the appellants treat their contingent assets and contingent liabilities asymmetrically. If the obligation to replace the borrowed security was a contingent liability that did not increase the amount realized on the sale, then the proceeds from the short sale should also be treated as a contingent asset that has no effect on the outside basis calculation under Section 722. The initial short sale that generates the cash proceeds and the subsequent covering transactions are inextricably linked, intertwined. To treat the $102 million short sale proceeds as an unencumbered cash contribution increases GMK's outside basis in value without also treating the obligation to close the short sale as a liability flies in the face of reality. The appellant's failure to treat its relief from partnership liabilities additional amount realized in Section 752D produces unwarranted aberrations in the amount of loss realized by the transferor. The taxpayer's attempt to argue, as the Sala court indicated, that the issue that such an obligation was not a liability was settled law that the IRS could not overturn via a revenue ruling was not taken terribly well by the Fifth Circuit. It indicates that none of the cases the taxpayer cites to show the settled law deal with a short sale or with the issue of such a transaction as a matter on the matter of liabilities in 752. They first deal with the Hendricks v. Commissioner case, 51-235 from 1968. There, the tax court held capital losses sustained by the taxpayer in a short sale were deductible in the tax year the taxpayer actually delivered the securities to the lender to close the short position, not the tax year the replacement securities were actually purchased by the taxpayer. Hendricks simply affirms a principle contained in Treasury Regulation 1.233-1A1 that a short sale is not consummated until delivery of the property closes a short sale. It has nothing to do with the calculation of a partner's outside basis in his partnership interest. The court's rather clear in that quotation that it did not believe there is any linkage whatsoever in 1233 and that the whole 1233 theory goes out the window. The Helmer case and Revenue Ruling 73301 are the next item the court deals with and dismisses. The court notes, in Helmer v. Commissioner, a partnership received option payments pursuant to an agreement giving a corporation the option to purchase certain real estate. The tax court stated the option agreement created no liability on the part of the partnership to repay the funds paid nor to perform any services in the future. Therefore, we hold that no liability arose under Section 72 and the partner's basis cannot be increased by such amount. In Revenue Ruling 73301, The IRS found the unrestricted progress payment on a two-year construction contract are not a liability under Section 72 that increases the partner's adjusted outside basis. Importantly, the partnership had performed all the services required to be entitled to receive the progress payment, and there was no obligation to return the payment or perform any additional services in order to retain it. Helmer and Revenue Ruling 73301 are distinguishable from this case because those partnerships did not receive assets giving rise to a partnership obligation. The taxpayers cited Revenue Ruling 5729, and the Fifth Circuit deals with that one as well. In Revenue Ruling 5729, the IRS stated that in computing the cost basis of assets for any purpose, the IRS does not recognize an obligation of a taxpayer reflected in an executory contract prior to performance of the contract. However, in the next sentence, the IRS noted that the executory contract at issue costs the taxpayer nothing and has a zero basis to him in computing ultimate gain or loss. The Fifth Circuit becomes very interested in the fact that in the cases cited, there was no basis generated in the asset in question. Finally, the Fifth Circuit deals with the remaining cases. The appellant seized on the general language in Long v. Commissioner from 1978, stating that the tax court has held a number of occasions that contingent and indefinite liabilities assumed by the purchaser of an asset are not part of the cost basis of an asset. We think that partnership liabilities should be treated in the same manner. However, the claims in Long arose from structural defects in the building that the partnership had erected, and the claims in LaRue v. Commissioner arose from a partnership's contractual obligation to replace missing property. The government correctly observes that Revenue Ruling 5729, Long, and LaRue did not involve obligations that created or increased the basis of the partnership's assets. For example, in Long, the tax court held the taxpayer could not increase his initial outside basis in the partnership until the partnership's contingent liability, a lawsuit, had a liquidated value. Before the claim was liquidated, this liability did not create or increase the partner's outside basis in his partnership interest. In contrast, the contingent liability in this case immediately increased the trust's outside basis in Valiant from $2 million to $104.5 million. Now, I'm sure the taxpayers would argue, wait, you're mixing apples and oranges here. That increase in basis took place outside of the partnership, while the activities in LaRue and in Long took place inside. But I doubt the Fifth Circuit's terribly concerned. They're looking more inside the box to find an economic event, and they're saying there was no economic event that generated a huge amount of basis with no offsetting liability. Finally, the court concludes, under Skidmore, we believe Revenue Rulings 9526 and 9545 are reasonable because they reflect the commissioner's desire to prevent taxpayers from deducting non-economic losses. We do not believe the appellants were unfairly surprised or prejudiced by the IRS's challenge to this tax shelter because they were on notice as early as 1988, and certainly by 1995, the IRS considered the obligation to close a short sale to be a liability under Section 72. Revenue Ruling 9526 is distinguishable from earlier cases and revenue rulings cited by the appellants and is fully consistent with the regulations promulgated by the IRS after 1995. What about the Regulation 1.7562 that the Sala and Simcoe courts were so involved in? The Fifth Circuit tells us simply that since they've ruled it's a liability, Reg 1.752-6 by its own terms doesn't apply. The court notes, we conclude the obligation to close the short sale as a liability for purposes 752. We express no opinion of the other interests raised by the parties. We do note, however, that the Seventh Circuit recently held that the offsetting option variant of the Son of Boss talc shelter was invalid under retroactive Treasury Regulations 1.752-6. By its own terms, this Treasury regulation only applies if a partnership assumes liability of a partner other than liability which Section 752A and B apply. Because we find the obligation to close the short sales liability which 752A and B apply, we conclude this regulation is inapplicable to this case. It's not relevant if that reg is valid, invalid, could be applied retroactively or not, because that regulation has as much relevance to this case in the Fifth Circuit's view as the outside temperature today does to the case. Now, what about economic substance? In a concurring opinion, Judge King complained that the court had been forced to rule on this as a matter of law rather than dealing with the sham underlying it. He notes, I concur in the judgment of the panel and in the panel's opinion. I write separately to express my unease with what we have been asked to do here. The basic problem with this case is that the underlying transactions have absolutely no economic substance. The Internal Revenue Service seeks a rule of law from a circuit court to dispose of this case and others without being put to the expense and delay of litigating the fact-bound question of whether these transactions should be recharacterized for tax purposes under the no economic substance and step transaction doctrines. The result is a rule of law addressing what is here a pretense, an unsettling undertaking. What's our takeaway from this case? Well, if you have a taxpayer who invests in a son-in-law shelter, is under examination by the IRS, and they reside in the Fifth Circuit, it's pretty clear why this should be of interest to you. But assuming that's not the case for most of us, there's still useful information. I find that many practitioners have trouble dealing with partnership concepts, or even worse, are not even aware of what parts of partnership law they don't know and attempt to apply corporate concepts or other non-partnership concepts when partnership rules should be applied. The simple matter of the presumed distribution of cash that the code says takes place when a taxpayer's share of liabilities goes down can trip up a lot of taxpayers. Just this past week on the California Society's discussion boards at groupsyahoo.com, the Tax Talk is the name of the group. If you want to join it, it's open to CPAs and attorneys. We were discussing that you can't abandon a partnership interest, generally get an ordinary loss under 165, due to the fact that any liability release of Section 752 will almost always convert that transaction to a sale, triggering capital loss treatment. Note as well, we do need to be concerned about the cases discussed and the fact patterns discussed where a liability wasn't a liability. The Helmer result and the result we had with the contract with progress payments would both create cash in the company or in the partnership that could, if distributed to the partners, trigger a gain if the partners don't otherwise have enough basis in their partnership interest to support that distribution without worrying about the inflow that came in. That's something that would be easy for a lot of taxpayers to stumble into, because if I just sold an option, I get to take that cash and use it. If I personally owned the real estate and sold the option, I get to take the cash and use it. It illustrates the problem we run into in partnerships about sometimes we look at a partnership as an entity. Sometimes we look at it as simply an aggregation of a bunch of individual owners, and we look through all the way as if the individuals own those pieces directly. If you're not sure which way you're being taxed, you can come up with answers that don't necessarily come out the way you think they should. I don't think most taxpayers would initially believe the Helmer result made sense. Now, since it's a partnership matter, I'm going to be doing some partnership course lectures a couple times this year. I thought I'd let you know about some of those courses coming up. Most of you are probably aware I do some CPE presentations for state societies to a limited extent during the year. And I'm going to be in St. Louis in August doing a full-day presentation for the Missouri Society of CPAs on partnerships. So if you're in the St. Louis area, you might consider taking a look at the Missouri Society if you want to come out, and we'll go through the full day's presentation on partnerships, LLCs, and run our way all through the 700 series just to have a joyous time that day. As well, I'll be doing this again on three different days in October in California for the California Education Foundation. It'll be following the October 5th deadline, the week following that deadline, and I'll be doing it one day in Sacramento, one day in San Francisco, one day in Pasadena. Now, that week, I'm always going to do an S-Corporation course on the two other days that week when we have open during the weekdays. First S-Corporation course will be in Sacramento. The second one will be in Los Angeles. I also should remind those in Arizona, I'm going to be doing a few sessions here as well. I'll be doing a session on computer security at the Financial Planning Conference for the Arizona Society of CPAs coming up in June. A full day on Arizona tax practice and ethics, a course which qualifies for the Arizona ethics credit, in Phoenix the following week. And a lecture over lunch on using virtual machines to continue to run Windows XP even when you transition to Vista in July. I look forward to seeing you guys at that event, any of you who are available. And our events will begin to later in this year. And right now it looks as if I'm going to be doing at least some events in Wyoming, Nevada, Ohio, Oregon, Virginia, and Maryland. So if you're a member of one of those state societies, you might take a look at their calendar. I'll be doing full-day presentations in all of those states except Virginia. Virginia, I'll be back at the Virginia Accounting and Auditing Conference again this year, once in Roanoke, the second time in Virginia Beach. Now, this has been the Tax Update Podcast, and as always, it's brought to you by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.linebergservices.com. Be sure to visit them on the web and take a look at the information they have available for CPAs, EAs, attorneys, and others who have an interest in tax matters. Again, they're on the web at www.linebergservices.com. This has been the Tax Update.